Hi, thanks for taking 20 minutes out of your day to come to this talk. My name is Steve Springett, and today we're going to be talking about how to operationalize software bill of materials using OWASP Dependency Track. So a little bit about me before we dive in. I'm the creator of the OWASP Dependency Track project. I am the chair of the OWASP Cyclone DX Core Working Group, which is a software bill of materials standard. I'm the leader and co-author of the OWASP Software Component Verification Standard, which helps organizations measure and improve their software supply chain assurance. I'm one of the admins of the package URL spec, participate in a lot of different working groups, and what I actually get paid to do is lead a bunch of security architects over at ServiceNow. So Dependency Track is a flagship OWASP project. It was founded in 2013. At this point, it's highly mature. We have a large, vibrant community of adopters and contributors, dedicated Slack channels, over 6 million Docker pulls at this point. It's open source, Apache 2.0 licensed. And again, it is designed specifically around SBOM. So what is an SBOM? Just real quick to level set, it is a list of ingredients, right? In this particular case, this is an energy bar. And as a consumer of this energy bar, this allows me to make better risk-based decisions. For example, if I have allergies to tree nuts, well, having peanuts on the list of ingredients is my kind of indication that this may not be the right type of energy bar for me. Software bill of materials, or SBOMs, provide a similar type of capability for, well, software. So what does the Dependency Track project do? Well, it consumes, analyzes, and produces SBOMs at high velocity. Huh, that sounds interesting. Which makes it ideal for use in modern build pipelines. Think DevSecOps here. But there's also a bunch of APIs and as well as manual use cases under the covers as well, which makes it ideal for both procurement and mergers and acquisitions. It is designed to quickly identify what is affected and where in my environment is it affected. So conceptually, I might have an asset, right? Think an enterprise CMDB, for example, where I might have tens or hundreds of thousands of assets in my environment, everything from servers and workstations to printers and, IoT toasters and cameras and everything else. Well, I have an asset and I have a bill of materials for that asset. It would contain not only the software, but it could contain the services and hardware itself. So I have an asset, I have a bill of material, and I analyze it. Pretty simple, right? Under the covers, this is going down a little bit deeper. This is actually what happens. So I produce a software bill of materials, step one. I can also obviously acquire these from suppliers. Step two is I ingest that into Dependency Track. Dependency Track consumes it either, via REST or manual upload. There's Jenkins plugins, there's command line interfaces, there's all kinds of ways to consume it in Dependency Track. And once it's in Dependency Track, well, it analyzes it for known security, operational, and license risk. And once it's in Dependency Track, it continuously monitors the inventory for every single project that it's tracking, right? Every 24 hours and a minimum, the entire inventory is analyzed for security, operational, and license risk. But keeping all that data in Dependency Track isn't overly useful. So we have a lot of different ways to stream that data outside of the platform. For example, webhooks being one of them, so that we can provide enough intelligence about what is affected, the severity, where in your environment, everything about the vulnerability, everything about the asset, so that you can then, make automated risk-based response to that. So now that the PowerPoint is out of the way for the most part, let's dive into a demo. So this is the very first thing that you'll see when you log into Dependency Track. Right here, I'm looking at a dashboard. I have a number of time series metrics on my dashboard. At the top here, we've got the number of vulnerabilities in my portfolio over time. I got the number of projects at risk over time, number of components, vulnerable components, and an inherited risk score. In the middle, I have all my vulnerabilities in my portfolio, broken down by criticality, critical high, medium, lows. And I got some other time series metrics down here as well. But let's go into the projects view. Everything in Dependency Track is grouped by project. And a project could be a piece of software, microservice, desktop app, could be an IoT toaster. Doesn't really matter what a project represents as long as it has a name and optionally a version. So as you can see here, I've got 11 projects in my portfolio. And it's here's the name of this particular project, the version, the last time the bill of material was imported, the bill of material format and version, as well as a risk score and whether or not the project is active. The platform allows you to mark projects as inactive in the case that maybe you want to keep the results around, but maybe the software is retired, right? It's no longer in production. Therefore, it doesn't represent any risks to you anymore. So you can mark those projects as inactive so that your portfolio risk actually goes down and it's not impacted by that legacy thing, as well as the number of vulnerabilities in that particular project. You can create new projects right here, but let's go into the OWASP WebGoat project. WebGoat is a kind of a legacy project. It's a vulnerable by design web application designed for educational purposes. And again, we have very similar time series metrics here. Again, hovering over these things, I get a little bit of a breakdown of you know what the number of vulnerabilities by severity. And click on the components tab over here. And this tells me the number of components in my inventory. I've got 136 components that was in my bill of materials. And it has a list of what those are. This is the name of the component, the version. Whether or not the component is out of date, yellow indicating that it is, green indicating it's not, or green indicating it's the latest version. Optionally, if the language or ecosystem supports it, a group identifier, the license that the bill of material had, risk score, and whether or not it has any vulnerabilities. Now, you can manually add components as well. If you don't have a bill of materials, Cyclone DX bill of materials document with you, you can manually add these things and remove these things if you want. This is primarily for, well, legacy ecosystems that don't rely on package managers, that don't want to create source SBOMs. They actually want real, like what the components are type of SBOMs. So you have some manual use cases in here as well. And it's at a high level, it's a lot of the same information that would be in a typical bill of material where you've got the identifying information about the component, the type of component it is, license, hash values, you know, that sort of thing. All that can be manually added if you want to. But the one manual use case that a lot of organizations do use is to upload the BOM manually. Now, in a typical DevOps pipeline, you're going to use Jenkins or CircleCI, GitHub Actions, whatever the case is, and you're going to just throw it at Dependency Track and it's just going to consume it and analyze it through automation. However, if you get SBOMs from your suppliers doing procurement or M&A, you're typically going to upload them like this. You're going to create a project, upload the bill of materials, and you'll have a view, something like this. Now, if WebGoat had any services defined, they would be here. The services view actually gives you, similar view to the components, but it breaks down what the services are, all the endpoint URLs for that service, the providers of those service, the data classifications and the directional flow of data going to and from that service, trust boundary traversals, authentication requirements, all that information is in the services. Dependency graph is here as well. So we can actually interact with the graph. We can, from the WebGoat parent component, we can go into any of the child components and keep on drilling down if we want. Now, as a human being, I can go in there and make audit decisions as well. So depending on which statistics you look at, between 80 and 90% of all vulnerabilities that are inherited by an application are not necessarily exploitable, right? So just because I have a vulnerable component doesn't necessarily mean my application is exploitable. So as a human being, though, I can go into the audit functionality, and let's just pick one here, and make some audit decisions. It gives me a description of what the vulnerability is. I can work with my development and my security teams and determine whether or not my application is, in fact, vulnerable to this particular thing. And I can make comments as well as an analysis decisions. So if I mark something as exploitable, for example, I can fire off webhooks and all kinds of other things that would tell the development team to actually do some work. I can mark things as not an issue, not affected, and I can also mark things as not being a false positive. So if I mark something as not affected, for example, and I suppress the issue, that actually removes that vulnerability from my inherited risk score. So it's not counted against me. But let's see. So you have the audit trail here. I can make a comment. Just say this is not exploitable because whatever. So all of that is part of dependency track, and in a future version, that's also going to tie into the VEX capabilities of Cyclone DX as well. Cyclone DX supports this concept of vulnerability exploitability exchange that lets you communicate not just the vulnerabilities and components, but whether or not you're actually impacted by those vulnerabilities. So all this is going to tie together. And if I had any policy violations as well, no, I don't have any policies set up, but we'll if we have some time, we'll take a look at that as well. So this is the project view. I can go in and edit different aspects of the project, give it a name. I can add tag values to the project, say this is a Java project, and internet facing, right? So maybe those are the two tags I want to add. I can give it some additional identifying information. I can give it some additional properties, which are just kind of these name value pair type things. And it also allows me to then, I've gotten these two tags now here. I can now search for, all my internet facing applications, for example. Looks like this is the only one. But anyway, these tags really allow you to group and sort things, which is really fun. Allows you to really identify the things that you might want to care about first, like internet facing, or maybe you want to put different types of data classifications in there as tags. So things that might handle PCI or HIPAA or personally identifiable financial information, for example. You might want to create tags for the data classifications. You also have a way to search your entire portfolio for components based on a lot of different factors, right? You can search based on their coordinates. You can search based on their package URL or their CPE. You can search based on their SWID tag IDs. So these are all kind of ways that components are identified. You can also search based on hash values. So if you know a particular component, a malicious version of a component has a specific hash value, for example, you can actually search your entire portfolio for that particular hash value. But I'm just going to search by component because, you know what, I'm really, really interested in, maybe I'm interested in Jackson Databind. So I'm going to search for Jackson Databind. And these are all of my projects that actually have Jackson Databind in there. So the projects are over here, and I can go to the individual components. So let's just check. Let's go back to my WebGoat example. So this is my WebGoat example. So this is Jackson Databind in WebGoat. So if I wanted to really quickly identify, maybe it was Log4j or H2, something that's kind of recent, that top of mind. So let's Log4j. So these are all of my applications that have Log4j. and tells me the name and version, what projects it's in. So really simple way to identify what potentially applications are potentially impacted by this. But I can also go through this the other way, right? Maybe I want to search by the CVE or the GitHub Security Advisory ID, right? I can do that as well. So maybe I want to search for 2020-35491, I think it is. Oops, I guess it would help if I put a zero there. There we go. Okay, so I'm curious on this vulnerability because this is a Jackson Databind vulnerability that's pretty exploitable. And it tells me everything I need to know about the vulnerability and all my reference material, but it also tells me what projects are affected by this vulnerability. So this allows me to come at this from many, many different angles to be able to very quickly identify what is affected in my environment, and if so, where. So this is really, really important. But security isn't the only use case. We do support licenses. So we have full SPDX license ID support, license expression support, I think is on the radar as well. But this allows you to basically just identify, well, this is basically just the license information from the SPDX project itself, license text, templates, etc. So this kind of ties into the component licensing capabilities that we were showing earlier. You can also set up policies. So we could create a policy, for example. Well, here I've got an example for prohibited components. So maybe I want to define a policy that says my coordinates, anything with log4j, I don't care what group, I don't care what group or version it is. I want to warn on anything with log4j. So this would allow me to set up that kind of policy. But I can also do other things. For example, I can also say, maybe I want to go by severity, right? So if the severity of something is a certain, thing, I can do policy violations based on that. I can do it based on license. So individual license, for example, maybe my organization is allergic to the AGPL, for example. I could make a policy that has that. I can also go by license group. So we've got some license groups already defined. So maybe my organization does not want copyleft. Maybe that's not what they want to do. I can do package URL, CPE, SWID tag IDs as well. And then the violations, you'll get notified of those as well. The license groups are over here. Again, it comes out of the box with some defaults. So here's the copy left, for example, and you can change these. These are just what's provided out of the box, but feel free to modify these to your heart's content. So that's really what dependency track is in a nutshell. It allows you to very quickly identify what is affected, and if so, where in your environment is affected. So with these use cases, this is a big win for operationalizing SBOMs. In fact, multiple world governments actually refer to Dependency Track as a reference implementation for how to operationalize SBOMs. The platform integrates with a lot of different things, and more things are coming all the time. So these are just some of the integrations that we have today. A little bit about the project itself. Again, everything is open source. Here's a link to our GitHub, as well as some social links that we have. Our documentation is pretty good as well.